The following audiobooks contain AI-generated content and may contain errors. This audiobook narration presents Life Insurance Essentials, a framework for graduate and early career professionals in the United States. Topic Introduction. Life insurance is a promise that turns the uncertainty of death into cash the household or firm can use to replace income, pay debts, and preserve plans. That simple economic purpose sits inside complex contracts, corporate balance sheets, regulatory rules, and human decisions. Learners arrive in this subject because the stakes are real. Many households remain uninsured or underinsured, even as underwriting, distribution, and the macroeconomic context change. Those changes make clear thinking about what is guaranteed and what is projected more important than ever. This three-part lecture is designed for graduate-level listeners and early career professionals preparing to sell, analyze, or compare life insurance in the United States. It blends theory, firm-level evidence, and hands-on practice. Rather than reciting product names, it gives you the language to read a policy, to separate contractual guarantees from non-guaranteed projections, and to judge whether a design fits a household or business problem. It also prepares you to explain those judgments plainly in client conversations and in interviews. The course moves from foundations to firm evidence to practical application. First, we build the foundational logic of risk pooling and the key actors who make a policy work. Then we narrow the lens to a major mutual carrier to see how governance, dividend practice, ratings, and distribution shape product choices in the market. Finally, we translate that evidence into disciplined needs analysis, suitability and replacement practice, ethical objection handling, and interview readiness grounded in regulatory realities. A single practical tension threads the whole lecture: how to reconcile long-term contractual promises with non-guaranteed outcomes and the policy owner's responsibility to fund and monitor flexible designs. That tension appears in dividend talk at mutual companies, in the lapse risk of flexible products, in accelerated underwriting and digital placement, and in the ethical trade-offs producers face when compensation differs across options. We will return to it repeatedly, using concrete examples rather than slogans. Listen for clarity of principle and for the habits of disciplined speech. The best professional work here is not product enthusiasm, but precise explanation. Start with the client's need, name what the contract actually guarantees, show what depends on future experience, and document the reasoning. If you leave able to separate promise from projection, to match product architecture to durable need, and to describe those choices clearly and compliantly, you will have gained the central practical skill this field demands. End of introduction. In the United States, awareness of life insurance remains elevated after the pandemic, but ownership remains incomplete. Industry surveys indicate that roughly half of adults have coverage, and many who say they need insurance believe they need more. That gap matters because life insurance does one specific job inside a financial plan. It creates cash when a death removes income, triggers debt obligations, or leaves survivors with expenses they cannot postpone. For an early career professional, that is why product fluency and ethical judgment come before brand talk and before any illustration. If the contract is not understood at the level of guarantees, assumptions, and household need, the sales conversation starts on the wrong foundation. Life insurance is easy to describe badly because protection, savings, investing, taxes, and legacy can blur together. The clearest starting point is its basic role. At the household level, life insurance most often serves income replacement. When a wage earner dies, the death benefit can stand in for income that stops immediately. It can also extinguish debt, preserve housing, protect education funding, and cover final expenses. In some cases, it creates estate liquidity, meaning ready cash when an estate is tied up in property, a closely held business, or other illiquid assets. In business planning, it can fund a buy-sell arrangement, protect against the loss of a key person, or give a firm time to stabilize after a death. Seen that way, life insurance is not mysterious. It is a tool for turning uncertainty about the timing of death into a funded obligation. Before product families come into view, the main actors in the system need to be clear. The policy owner controls the contract. That person pays premiums, exercises contractual rights, and names or changes beneficiaries unless the policy has been assigned or otherwise restricted. The insured is the person whose life is covered. Often the policy owner and the insured are the same person, but they do not have to be. The beneficiary is the person, trust, charity, or business that receives the death benefit when the insured dies. The producer is the licensed professional who solicits the application, explains the policy, gathers information, and helps place coverage with a carrier. Consumers often say agent, but producer is the broader regulatory term. The underwriter sits on a different part of the process. The underwriter evaluates a specific application and decides whether the carrier accepts the risk, on what terms, and sometimes at what price class. The actuary works at a different level again. Actuaries model mortality, expenses, lapses, reserves, and investment assumptions across a large pool of policies so products can be priced and managed responsibly. The carrier is the insurance company that issues the contract, collects premiums, invests assets, holds reserves, and pays valid claims. State regulators oversee this system. In the United States, insurance regulation is primarily state-based, so state insurance departments license producers, review forms, monitor solvency, and enforce market conduct rules. Rating agencies are not regulators, but they matter because they publish opinions about a carrier's financial strength and claims-paying ability. For promises that may last decades, both legal oversight and financial strength analysis matter, even though a rating is not itself a guarantee. Life insurance works through risk pooling. Many policy owners pay premiums into a common financial pool. Only a fraction of insureds die in any given period, so the carrier does not need each premium to equal that policy's full death benefit. Instead, the carrier needs enough premium across the pool, together with investment income, to pay expected claims, cover expenses, and maintain reserves. The carrier is not predicting the exact date of death for one person. It is managing the expected pattern of claims across many lives. Actuaries model that pattern. Underwriters protect the pool at the individual level by screening for risk characteristics that would otherwise distort pricing. Premiums, therefore, do several jobs at once. They support expected death claims, cover commissions and administration, help fund reserves, and enter the insurer's investment process until claims are paid. If experience turns out favorable, the result may support surplus or dividends on participating contracts. If experience worsens, the strain can appear in profitability, reserves, or dividend capacity. The core logic stays the same. A large pool turns uncertain individual loss into a more predictable collective pattern. The next distinction governs many misunderstandings in life insurance. Some policy elements are guaranteed, and some are not. A guaranteed element is written into the contract. If the stated conditions are met, the carrier is bound to honor it. A non-guaranteed element depends on future experience, future carrier decisions within contract limits, or future market results. That line between promise and projection becomes crucial once dividends, credited rates, and investment performance enter the picture. In one policy, the guaranteed feature may be a fixed premium or a guaranteed cash value schedule. In another, it may be the right to renew coverage without new evidence of insurability. By contrast, dividends on participating policies are typically not guaranteed. Interest credited above a contractual minimum is not guaranteed. Indexed caps, participation rates, and market-based sub-account values are not guaranteed. An illustration can show what a policy may do under stated assumptions, but it does not turn assumptions into promises. The contract controls. That distinction is ethical as well as technical. A producer who blurs guaranteed values with optimistic projections is not simply being imprecise. The producer is misdescribing the contract. Term life insurance sits at the simplest end of the product map. It provides coverage for a specified period. If the insured dies during that period, the carrier pays the death benefit. If the insured survives the term, standard term insurance ends without a cash value payout because the contract is not built to accumulate one. That simplicity explains why term usually offers the lowest entry cost for a given amount of death benefit. The premium funds pure mortality protection for a limited stretch of time, not lifetime coverage and not internal savings. Term therefore fits especially well when the need is large but temporary, as with mortgage years, dependent care years, or a period of peak income reliance. One feature deserves careful attention. When a term policy is guaranteed renewable, coverage can continue without new proof of insurability. That protects access after a health change. It does not preserve the original price. Renewal premiums usually rise, often sharply, because the insured is older and the risk of death has increased. In plain terms, renewability protects access, not youthful pricing. Whole life moves from temporary protection to permanent protection. A whole life policy is designed to remain in force for the insured's lifetime as long as required premiums are paid. It combines a guaranteed death benefit with guaranteed cash value. That cash value builds on a schedule stated in the policy and generally accumulates on a tax-deferred basis within federal rules. Whole life also uses fixed premiums, and that fixed structure is central to the design. Early premiums do more than pay the cost of insurance for 1 year. They help pre-fund later years, when the pure cost of mortality would otherwise be much higher. That pre-funding supports level premiums, lifetime coverage, and cash value growth. On participating policies, the carrier may also pay dividends if overall experience supports them. Dividends can be taken in cash, used to reduce premiums, left to accumulate, or used to buy additional paid-up coverage, depending on policy terms and elections. The key point is that the guaranteed base policy stands on its own. Dividends may enhance value, but they are not promised. The trade-off is straightforward. Whole life premiums are materially higher than term premiums for the same initial death benefit because the policy is doing more. Universal life takes the permanent idea and rearranges the mechanics. Instead of bundling the design as tightly as whole life, it separates key moving parts. Premiums are flexible within policy rules. The death benefit may be adjustable. Cash value receives interest crediting, and monthly charges for insurance and expenses are deducted from that value. This can make the product feel more adaptable because the policy owner may vary funding over time. But flexibility changes the discipline required. A universal life policy stays in force only if the policy's value and funding pattern are sufficient to cover ongoing deductions. If funding is light, or credited interest is lower than expected, the policy can lose durability and eventually lapse. That lapse risk is central, not incidental. Universal life is not simply a cheaper whole life policy with extra freedom. The freedom is real, but so is the maintenance burden. A policy can appear healthy for years and then require substantially higher funding to remain in force. That is why the difference between guaranteed and non-guaranteed values matters so much in current assumption products. An illustration may show a policy lasting for decades under one interest assumption, while the guaranteed path tells a much stricter story. Indexed universal life is a form of universal life that links credited interest to an external market index through a formula. The cash value is not the same as direct ownership of the stocks in that index. Instead, the carrier credits interest according to policy terms that often include a floor, a cap, or a participation rule. Compared with fixed interest universal life, indexed universal life offers more upside potential when market conditions are favorable. It also brings more complexity. The crucial questions are how the crediting method works, which features are guaranteed, which features can change, and how policy charges interact with credited interest. A floor on credited interest does not mean the policy cannot lose ground after monthly charges are deducted. A cap or participation limit can also prevent the cash value from matching a strong market period. For that reason, indexed universal life requires more explanation at sale and more ongoing monitoring after issue than many consumers first expect. Variable life and variable universal life move even closer to the language of investing. In these policies, cash value is placed in investment subaccounts, so market performance directly affects policy value. Variable life generally combines permanent insurance with market-based cash value and a more structured premium pattern. Variable universal life adds universal life's funding flexibility and often an adjustable death benefit to that market exposure. The appeal is easy to state. If the underlying investments perform well, cash value growth can be stronger than in policies that rely on fixed crediting. Policy owners can usually reallocate among subaccounts within the contract without a current tax event inside the policy. But market exposure changes the nature of the risk. Poor investment results can reduce cash value, and if funding is insufficient, policy durability can weaken. In other words, variable products place insurance planning and investment risk inside the same structure. That can be useful, but it leaves little room for vague explanation. A permanent policy with market exposure has to be monitored as both insurance and investment risk. Once the major product families are in view, underwriting deserves separate attention. Underwriting is not merely back office administration. It is part of how the product is experienced in the market. Traditional underwriting relies on a fuller review of the applicant's health and risk profile. That may include detailed health questions, prescription history, medical records, laboratory work, or a paramedical exam. It often remains the path for applicants with more complex medical, personal, or financial circumstances, or for cases where the carrier needs deeper evidence before offering terms. Accelerated underwriting does not mean the absence of underwriting. It means the carrier uses application data, third-party information, and predictive models to approve some applicants with less friction and, in many cases, without an exam. Younger and healthier applicants are often more likely to qualify, although eligibility varies by carrier and case design. Some applicants begin on an accelerated path and then move to traditional underwriting if the available data do not support a fast decision. The rise of accelerated underwriting matters because speed and convenience affect completion rates. A household that hesitates over an exam may still complete an application if the process is faster and less intrusive. Product knowledge, therefore, includes issue path knowledge. A policy is not just a bundle of benefits. It is also a process for getting coverage in force. Even at an introductory stage, One Tax Foundation belongs in the discussion because it shapes permanent insurance design. Under the Internal Revenue Code, Section 7702 helps define whether a contract qualifies as life insurance for federal tax purposes. The favorable treatment associated with life insurance does not arise simply because a contract has a death benefit. The contract also has to fit within the statutory framework that defines life insurance rather than some other financial arrangement. Related rules under Section 7702A govern modified endowment contracts. When a permanent policy is funded too aggressively relative to those rules, it can become a modified endowment contract. The policy does not stop being life insurance, and the death benefit generally remains income tax-free to beneficiaries. But access to cash value can lose some of the favorable treatment that many owners expect from a non-modified endowment cash value policy. In short, the tax code does not ask only whether a policy has cash value. It also asks how the policy has been structured and funded. This is general educational information, not individualized financial or tax advice. Specific policy decisions should be reviewed with a licensed professional and, when relevant, a qualified tax advisor. A spoken comparison makes these differences more concrete. Suppose a needs analysis shows that a household has a substantial protection need because earners support dependents, debt remains outstanding, and future goals would be disrupted by an early death. If the death benefit target stays constant, term, whole life, and universal life address that same need in very different ways. A term illustration emphasizes a specified coverage period, a stated death benefit during that period, and no cash value. The key questions are how long the level premium lasts and what happens at renewal. A whole life illustration addresses the same death benefit with fixed premiums, lifetime coverage if required premiums are paid, a guaranteed cash value schedule, and possibly non-guaranteed dividends on a participating contract. The key questions shift to the guaranteed values and the difference between the guaranteed path and any dividend-enhanced path. A universal life illustration addresses the same protection target with flexible funding, monthly charges, credited rate assumptions, and projections that must be read against both guaranteed and non-guaranteed elements. The key questions become planned premium, ongoing deductions, and how long the policy is projected to remain in force under different assumptions. The household need has not changed across those illustrations. What changes is the contract architecture and the kind of discipline the policy demands. The comparison becomes clearer when it is tied to common fact patterns. One common pattern is a young household with earned income doing most of the financial work, limited liquid savings, and obligations that are heavy now but not necessarily permanent. The central problem in that pattern is income protection. The death of an earner would threaten cash flow, housing stability, and dependent support. In that setting, term often fits the shape of the problem because the need is large, budget sensitivity is high, and much of the need is temporary. The ethical mistake here is not simply choosing the wrong carrier. It is letting fascination with cash value or product complexity crowd out the first responsibility, which is closing the basic protection gap. A second common pattern involves a higher earner who already saves consistently, may own a business, and is asking whether some need is truly permanent rather than temporary. Here the question changes. Is there a lifelong objective, such as estate liquidity, business continuation, or another enduring obligation that survives the high dependency years, or is the need still mostly income replacement that declines over time? If the need is genuinely lifelong, permanent insurance may deserve serious analysis. Then the choice between whole life and some form of universal life turns on the desired balance of guarantees, flexibility, and ongoing monitoring. If the need is not lifelong, pure protection may still be the cleaner answer, even in a higher income household. Income alone does not dictate product type, duration of need, tolerance for funding variability, and clarity about guarantees matter more. At this point, the product landscape can be sorted into a few useful memory buckets. If a product offers coverage for a limited period and no cash value, it belongs in the temporary bucket. That is term. If a product is designed to remain in force for life, assuming required premiums or adequate funding, it belongs in the permanent bucket. Whole life, universal life, indexed universal life, variable life, and variable universal life all belong there, but not in the same way. If a product allows premiums or death benefit features to be adjusted within policy limits, it also belongs in the flexible bucket. Universal life, indexed universal life, and variable universal life fit most clearly here. If a product exposes cash value directly to market subaccounts, it belongs in the investment-linked bucket. Variable life and variable universal life fit there. Indexed universal life is better understood as index-linked crediting, not direct investment-linked cash value, which is why it needs its own careful explanation. A simple learning check follows from those buckets. When hearing any life insurance description, the first question is whether the need being addressed is temporary or permanent. The second is whether the contract is rigid or flexible in funding and design. The third is whether the values being highlighted are guaranteed or dependent on dividends, credited rates, or market performance. A fourth question is just as useful. Who bears more of the risk if future experience disappoints? In a strongly guaranteed design, more of that burden stays with the carrier. In a more flexible or market-sensitive design, more of it shifts to the policy owner. Those questions do not solve every case, but they do prevent many early errors. They also show why product knowledge and ethical judgment have to develop together. Technical fluency without candor can mislead. Good intentions without real product understanding can mislead as well. The responsible standard is higher. It requires clear explanation of the problem a policy is meant to solve, the rights and duties the contract creates, the values that are guaranteed, the values that are not, and the degree of monitoring the policy will demand over time. The basic map is now in place. Life insurance exists to create liquidity at death for households and businesses facing income loss, debt, estate obligations, or final expenses. The policy owner controls the contract. The insured is the life covered. The beneficiary receives the proceeds. The producer explains and places the policy. The underwriter evaluates the applicant. The actuary prices and manages the pool. The carrier issues the promise. The state regulator oversees the system, and the rating agency offers an outside opinion on financial strength. Term provides temporary protection with no cash value. Whole life provides permanent protection with fixed premiums, guaranteed cash value, and a guaranteed death benefit, with possible but non-guaranteed dividends on participating policies. Universal life provides permanent coverage with flexible funding and real lapse risk if it is poorly funded. Indexed universal life adds index-linked crediting, more upside potential than fixed crediting, and more complexity. Variable life and variable universal life add market subaccounts and investment risk inside the policy. Across all of them, the most important intellectual line remains the line between what the carrier guarantees and what the future may or may not deliver. With the product map in place, the next move narrows from contract types to a single carrier large enough to show how the United States market behaves in practice. New York Life matters for that purpose. Public reporting identifies it as the largest mutual life insurer in the United States by revenue. It operates through roughly 12,000 agents and financial advisors, and it reports surplus and a general account large enough to make its balance sheet a notable point of comparison in the market. That scale is not merely a branding fact. A carrier of this size helps shape how permanent insurance is explained, how financial strength is discussed, and how consumers learn to separate company reputation from product fit. The mutual company structure is the first reason this case deserves special attention. In a mutual insurer, the residual interest sits with policyholders rather than with outside public shareholders. There is no publicly traded common stock whose owners expect quarterly earnings per share. That does not make a mutual charitable, and it does not mean policyholders manage the company day to day. What changes is the governance lens. Management can speak in terms of policyholder benefit, surplus strength, and long horizon stewardship without framing every decision around short-term shareholder returns. Practically, that can affect capital management, because a mutual relies more on retained earnings and surplus than on raising equity in public markets. It can affect how dividend language is framed, because favorable experience on participating policies may be returned to eligible policy owners. It can also affect market positioning, because a firm that is not built around stock price comparison often emphasizes decade-scale thinking rather than quarter-to-quarter performance. That said, mutual ownership is often romanticized. It does not mean every policy owner receives a dividend. It does not mean every product is better designed. Nor does it remove ordinary business constraints. The narrower and more useful point is simply this: structure influences incentives, and incentives influence which products become central to a firm's identity. the balance sheet terms that appear in annual reports, are therefore worth decoding. Surplus is the cushion remaining after liabilities. It helps an insurer absorb adverse mortality, investment stress, expense pressure, or other shocks. The general account is the main pool of assets that backs fixed policy promises. That differs from separate accounts used in variable contracts, where market performance drives policy value. When New York Life reports large surplus and general account figures, the practical implication is not bragging rights. The implication is that fixed guarantees and claims-paying commitments rest on a sizable asset base and a substantial capital cushion. Financial strength ratings merit careful but limited attention. Rating agencies such as AM Best, Fitch, Moody's, and Standard & Poor's publish opinions about an insurer's claims-paying ability. They are not regulators, and they do not insure a policy. They are independent analysts judging whether a company appears able to meet long-term obligations. New York Life sits in the top tier of the market. AM Best rates it. A++. Fitch rates it AAA. Moody's rates it AA1. Standard & Poor's rates it AA+. Those opinions matter because households that plan to rely on a promise for decades have reason to notice external views of claims-paying capacity. At the same time, ratings do not determine suitability. A high rating does not tell a buyer whether a given term face amount is large enough, whether a whole life premium is affordable, whether a universal life design is adequately funded, or whether a variable policy matches an owner's tolerance for market risk. Ratings answer one question. They never answer every question. If New York Life has a signature product story, it is participating whole life. That is where the distinction between guaranteed and non-guaranteed values becomes central. In a participating whole life policy, the base contract carries fixed premiums, a guaranteed death benefit, and guaranteed cash values that accrue according to the policy schedule. Those guarantees exist independently of future market performance. On top of that guaranteed base, the company may declare dividends for eligible participating policies. That second layer is often described too casually. Dividends are not guaranteed. They are not paid on every policy form. They should not be spoken of as if they were simply interest on an account. They are a distribution tied to company experience, commonly linked to mortality, expense, and investment results relative to the assumptions embedded in the participating block. New York Life projects a dividend payout of $2.78 billion to eligible participating policy owners in 2026. It describes that as the largest dividend payout in its history and as its 172nd consecutive annual dividend. Those headline figures signal scale and continuity. A projected payout measured in billions shows how important participating whole life remains to the company's identity. A record that spans more than a century shows continuity through very different economic environments. But history is not a contractual promise. Even at a mutual carrier with a long record, each future dividend remains subject to declaration. The company-wide headline does not translate mechanically to any single policy's outcome. An individual policy dividend depends on contract form, issue age, policy duration, face amount, and the elected dividend option. The headline should be heard as evidence that the participating system is real and large, not as a forecast of personal return. How dividends are used inside a participating whole life policy materially changes long-run outcomes. If an owner takes dividends in cash, the base policy continues exactly as guaranteed, but the dividend does not build additional in-policy value. If dividends reduce current premium outlay, the owner lowers present cash flow pressure but gives up some compounding that other elections could create. If dividends are left to accumulate at interest, the owner creates an additional value track whose future size depends on the credited rate. If dividends are used to buy paid-up additions, the policy acquires more paid-up coverage. Each addition increases both cash value and death benefit, and over time, can magnify future dividends. These choices can materially change a policy's trajectory. That is why practitioners must be cautious with phrases such as premium offset or self-supporting policy. An illustration may show dividends supporting out-of-pocket premiums at some future date, but that outcome depends on future dividend scales. The guaranteed base policy is one thing. A dividend-supported premium strategy is another. Mutual ownership and dividend payments are related concepts, but they are not identical. A mutual company is owned, in the corporate sense, by policy owners. Only eligible participating policies receive dividends. A term policy or a universal life policy issued by a mutual carrier does not become a dividend-paying whole life contract simply because the insurer itself is mutual. That distinction matters because New York Life's individual lineup is broader than its whole life reputation suggests. Company Materials Group individual life coverage into familiar categories such as term life, participating whole life, universal life, and variable universal life, with riders and options that vary by form and state. Product names differ by filing date and jurisdiction, which is one reason category-level understanding matters more than brand labels. Those categories also map to different guarantee profiles. Term addresses temporary protection and typically carries no cash value. Participating whole life offers permanent protection with fixed premiums and contractual cash value. Universal life provides permanent coverage on a more flexible chassis where credited interest, policy charges, and funding choices affect durability. Variable universal life introduces separate accounts and direct market exposure. That can create greater upside potential than fixed crediting designs, but it also increases uncertainty and demands closer monitoring. Riders such as disability premium relief, additional insured coverage, conversion options, or qualifying living benefits are not ornamental. They can materially change what problem a policy solves and how it behaves under stress. Across New York Life's lineup, the guarantee map is not uniform. In whole life, base premium schedules, base death benefits, and guaranteed cash values are contractual. Values that depend on future dividends are not contractual. In universal life, even contracts that state certain guarantees can still depend heavily on funding adequacy, policy owner behavior, and the relationship between credited interest and monthly deductions. A policy that looks durable under a current illustration can weaken if actual crediting runs lower, if premium payments are curtailed, or if policy loans are used aggressively. In variable universal life, non-guaranteed character becomes even more visible, because accumulation depends on the separate account's market performance and on allocation choices. Strong company ratings remain relevant in variable designs, but they cannot convert market volatility into a promise. This contrast between simplicity and flexibility is important in comparative terms. New York Life's whole life business leans toward insurer-born risk and contractual clarity. Its universal and variable offerings permit more flexibility, but shift more responsibility back to the owner. Comparing mutual peers sharpens the point. Northwestern Mutual and Mass Mutual also emphasize participating whole life and dividend history as central to identity. Across these mutual carriers, dividend tradition may signal discipline and scale, but dividends remain board-declared and non-guaranteed. Public company competitors look different at the margin. Firms such as Prudential, MetLife, and Brighthouse operate under governance that balances policyholder obligations with shareholder expectations. That difference can influence product emphasis and capital priorities. Public company firms often place relatively more weight on universal life, market-sensitive designs, workplace distribution, and annuities. New York Life's mutual identity, by contrast, keeps participating whole life and long-duration protection nearer the center of the story. Neither structure is inherently superior. The governance frame simply makes certain promises easier for a carrier to emphasize and certain sales narratives easier to sustain. Distribution then shapes how products reach the market. New York Life operates through an advice-led field force of roughly 12,000 agents and financial advisors. That is a large human distribution system, not only a digital quoting engine. The field model matters because permanent insurance is rarely bought well through a single price comparison. Someone must explain the difference between contractual guarantees and current assumptions, the effect of dividend elections, the implications of flexible premiums, and the reason a rider may or may not belong in a case. A well-trained and supervised field force can do that work. At the same time, the field model contrasts with carriers that emphasize direct-to-consumer term sales and a heavily digital buying journey. Some competitors pursue rapid online intake, aggressive accelerated underwriting, and minimal advisor involvement as a competitive advantage. That can be effective when the case is simple and the buyer values speed above all. New York Life competes in that same environment, but its identity remains more advice-led than click-led. That can feel less convenient for a shopper who wants an immediate answer, and more useful when the real question is whether the household needs term, whole life, universal life, or no permanent coverage at all. These firm-level differences sit inside broader market shifts. Whole life sales remain meaningful in the United States, indicating persistent demand for guarantees and stable cash value accumulation. At the same time, indexed universal life and variable universal life have gained market share compared with their positions before 2019, while fixed universal life has lost ground in many channels. One reason is the rate environment. Prolonged low yields make fixed crediting and rich guarantees harder to offer attractively. Another reason is narrative and distribution. Many distributors gravitate either toward the relative simplicity and guarantees of whole life, or toward the upside story of index-linked and market-linked designs. Consumer interest in accelerated underwriting grows alongside these product shifts, because friction in the application process affects whether a case is placed at all. Interest rates add another dimension. Life insurers invest heavily in high-quality fixed-income assets to back long-term promises. When rates stay low for extended periods, the spread between what a carrier earns and what it has promised tightens. That pressure can affect new product pricing, the attractiveness of fixed universal life, and dividend sustainability on participating blocks. Higher rates can improve yields on new money over time, but a long-duration balance sheet does not reset overnight. Large general accounts and substantial surplus cushions give management room to navigate slow-moving economic pressure without treating every short-term shift as a crisis. Tax code changes matter from a different angle. The federal definition of life insurance under Section 7702 shapes how much premium and cash value can sit inside a given death benefit structure. Changes to Section 7702 have made many permanent designs more cash value efficient than they were under prior rules. In plain language, the tax framework allows more room for funding and accumulation inside life insurance treatment. That affects illustration design, overfunding discussions, and how some policies are positioned in long-range planning. It does not, however, erase the duty to distinguish guaranteed from non-guaranteed values. A policy can become more tax-efficient and still depend heavily on current assumptions or future dividends. That separation becomes crucial when reading illustrations. Any responsible illustration must isolate contract guarantees from current assumption projections. In whole life, the dividend-enhanced line must not be allowed to obscure the guaranteed line. In universal life, current assumption projection cannot be treated as if lapse risk has vanished. In variable universal life, historical market returns cannot be casually imported into the future. The illustration is a model. The contract is the promise. Real industry debates make these cautions more than theoretical. Public litigation across the market shows repeated disputes over cost of insurance increases in universal life products. At the heart of many cases is a simple tension. Policy owners believe the contract limits how charges may change, while carriers invoke contractual discretion or changing economics. Whatever the legal outcomes, the existence of disputes signals a practical lesson. Flexible premium products can be misunderstood for many years before a problem becomes visible. Because New York Life offers universal life and variable universal life in addition to whole life, its reputation for guarantees does not exempt a practitioner from learning these risks. Lapse risk is another recurring issue. A universal life policy that is underfunded early can appear healthy for a long time. Then credited interest runs lower than illustrated. Charges consume more of the account than expected. And the owner receives notice that substantially higher premiums are needed to keep the policy in force. That is not a brand-specific mystery. It follows from the mechanics of flexible funding. A prestigious company name and excellent ratings do not cancel the arithmetic of underfunding. The sales risk that ties these debates together is the temptation to present optimistic non-guaranteed outcomes as if they were the expected result. That temptation appears when dividend illustrations are spoken like promises, when current assumptions are treated as an immutable future, or when variable projections quietly assume perpetual strong markets and disciplined behavior. Responsible practice requires a stricter habit of speech. Promise and possibility must remain in separate mental boxes. Two fact patterns make these points concrete. In the first, the client has strong and stable cash flow, a need that is genuinely permanent, and little interest in ongoing maintenance risk. The obligation may be business succession, estate liquidity, or a legacy goal that does not expire when children become independent. In that case, a participating whole life solution from a mutual carrier can be a strong fit. The base guarantees solve a lifelong problem with a fixed premium and a contractual value schedule. A mutual governance frame and high ratings add confidence that the long promise rests on a robust balance sheet. If dividends are declared and used for paid-up additions, the policy can grow beyond the guaranteed base. But the fit depends on permanence of need and the client's preference for guarantees, not on brand prestige alone. In the second pattern, the household faces a large but temporary protection gap. Earned income supports children, housing, and daily expenses. Liquidity is limited, and budget discipline is paramount. There is no clear permanent estate problem, and the immediate priority is protecting the family during high dependency earning years. There, a term recommendation may be the more responsible answer, even if commission economics differ. If the term product preserves conversion rights, that choice keeps future options open. The ethical point is simple: recommend enough affordable coverage for the actual risk rather than oversell permanence and leave the household underinsured. An advisor begins with the problem that needs solving, not with the product that pays most. After this firm-level comparison, three ideas must remain sharply separated. Company strength asks whether an insurer appears capable of keeping long-term promises. Product design asks how a contract allocates risk through guarantees, dividends, credited interest, market exposure, or flexible funding. Client suitability asks whether that design matches the household's need, budget, and tolerance for uncertainty. New York Life scores very high on the first question and offers multiple answers to the second. While its identity remains most closely tied to participating whole life and an advisor-led mutual model, neither point resolves the third question by itself. A strong company can still issue the wrong policy for a client. A technically sound product can still be the wrong product if the need is temporary, the budget is narrow, or the client will not maintain a flexible design properly. Holding those three ideas apart is how brand awareness becomes professional judgment. With the product map and the carrier comparison in place, the work becomes more demanding. Knowing how term, whole life, universal life, and variable products function is necessary, but it is not yet professional practice. The decisive shift is from knowing products to using them responsibly. In life insurance, the first discipline is not finding a product to sell. It is understanding the client need that exists before any recommendation is made. That starting point sounds obvious, but it corrects one of the most common errors in the field. A weak process begins with a favored contract, and then searches for facts that might justify it. A sound process does the reverse. It begins with obligations, goals, constraints, and risks, and only then asks which contract architecture fits. A needs analysis can be explained in a simple spoken sequence. It starts with earned income and the role that income plays inside the household. Which person produces the cash flow that pays for housing, food, childcare, debt service, taxes, and long-term saving? How much of that income would disappear at death? And for how long survivors would need replacement? Next come immediate cash needs. Death may create final expenses, debt payoff, mortgage obligations, business costs, or education funding needs that cannot be postponed. Then come existing resources. Those include liquid savings, investments, employer-provided coverage, individual policies already in force, and any other assets survivors could use without destabilizing the rest of the plan. Only after those steps does the protection gap become visible. The gap is not the face amount someone casually mentions. It is the shortfall between what survivors would need and what is already available. Once that gap appears, the conversation has to widen beyond arithmetic. A careful discovery process moves from household facts to goals, then to tolerance for risk, time horizon, liquidity needs, current coverage, and a realistic sense of how underwriting is likely to view the case. Goals matter because not every death benefit need lasts the same length of time. Some needs are temporary, such as dependent care during child-raising years or income replacement while a mortgage is still large. Some may be permanent, such as estate liquidity, a buy-sell obligation, or a business continuation problem. Risk tolerance matters because a client who values certainty may not be well served by a design that depends on flexible funding, future crediting, or market performance. Time horizon matters because a 10-year problem and a lifelong problem are not solved by the same structure. Liquidity matters because a policy that is affordable only on paper can become a future lapse. Current coverage matters because many households are less protected than they think, especially when they count group insurance without asking how far it would actually go. Underwriting profile matters because the recommendation has to be realistic about what can be placed, at what cost, and on what timeline. Several shorthand frameworks help organize this work, but each has limits. One common shortcut is the debt, income, mortgage, and education method, often called DIME. It is fast, memorable, and useful in an initial conversation because it forces attention to major obligations. It works best as a quick screen. It is rough by design, and it can miss existing assets, survivor earnings, taxes, special needs planning, or a need that declines over time. Human life value is another familiar framework. It tries to estimate the economic value of a person's future earnings or support to dependents. That can be useful when the central issue is income replacement, and it helps explain why life insurance is not merely a burial expense tool. But it is still a rough measure. It depends on assumptions about earnings growth, work life, discounting, and the share of income that actually supports others. It is informative, not final. Capital needs analysis goes deeper. Instead of relying on one broad multiplier or one mnemonic, it separates immediate obligations from ongoing income needs and then offsets those needs with available assets and existing coverage. For a simple household term case, DIME may be enough to reveal an obvious gap. For a higher income family, a business owner, a permanent coverage discussion, or any case where affordability and funding design matter, deeper capital needs analysis is more appropriate. The more complex the case becomes, the less acceptable it is to rely on a shortcut alone. A discovery conversation, therefore, has an ethical rhythm. It begins with facts, but it does not stop with facts. It asks what the household is trying to protect. What would happen if an income stopped tomorrow? How much uncertainty the client can tolerate? Whether flexibility would help or burden the case? What cash demands may arise before or after retirement? What coverage already exists? And how likely it is that underwriting will complicate the path? In a strong process, the product recommendation emerges late, not early. That delay is not hesitation. It is evidence that the producer is working from need to solution, rather than from inventory to sales pitch. Once a recommendation is considered, suitability and related recommendation standards become the governing idea. In practical terms, the recommendation has to fit the problem, the budget, the time horizon, and the client's ability to keep the policy in force. This becomes especially important with variable products and other designs that combine insurance with investment risk or flexible funding. A variable policy may be a poor fit if the client wants principal-like certainty, has low tolerance for market fluctuation, or is unlikely to monitor the policy. A flexible premium permanent design may be a poor fit if cash flow is unstable or if the plan depends on optimistic assumptions the client does not understand. Suitability is not satisfied by saying that a product has attractive features. It is satisfied when the facts gathered in discovery actually support the recommendation. That is why documentation matters so much. A file should show what need was identified, what information was gathered, what alternatives were considered, why the final recommendation matched the client's goals and finances, and what trade-offs were explained. Good documentation does not merely protect the producer. It disciplines the producer. It forces the reasoning onto paper, where weak logic becomes harder to hide. Replacement cases make that discipline even more important. Replacing existing life insurance is not just a new sale with extra signatures. It raises specific concerns because an older policy may contain values, terms, or advantages that a client loses by switching. The producer identifies all existing coverage that may be replaced. The client receives the required notices. The file records the advantages and disadvantages of replacing versus keeping the old policy. State rules vary, so the exact paperwork and timing differ. The underlying question stays the same. Does the replacement improve the client's position after costs, underwriting consequences, benefit changes, and durability are honestly considered? A replacement conversation is a poor place for shortcuts. If the older policy has guarantees that the new one lacks, that has to be said clearly. If the new policy solves a real problem that the old one does not solve, that also has to be documented clearly. The presence of a newer illustration never proves that replacement is wise. The producer has to show why the change serves the client, rather than merely generating new compensation. Compensation makes these questions harder, not easier. Permanent life insurance often pays higher commissions than term, and that creates a potential conflict of interest that should be addressed directly. The conflict does not mean every permanent recommendation is suspect. It means the producer has to earn credibility by showing that the recommendation survives scrutiny even when compensation differences are acknowledged. If a large temporary need exists and the household budget is tight, recommending adequate term coverage may be more responsible than recommending a smaller permanent policy that leaves the family underinsured. If a lifelong need exists, and the client values guarantees and can clearly afford the premiums, permanent coverage may be the better answer. The point is not to pretend commissions do not matter. The point is to make sure the case file, the oral explanation, and the actual recommendation all show that client need comes first. The maintenance side of life insurance also belongs to ethical practice, because a sale is not complete when a policy is delivered. Policies can lapse. They can be surrendered. They can sometimes be reinstated. Each outcome has practical consequences. A grace period is the limited time after a missed premium or insufficient funding during which coverage may still remain in force. If the deficiency is not cured, the policy can lapse and the protection can end. Surrender is the voluntary termination of the policy for whatever value the contract provides at that point. Reinstatement may be possible later, but it often requires payment of overdue amounts and may require new evidence of insurability, depending on the policy and the timing. These mechanics matter most where affordability is uncertain. An unaffordable, flexible premium product can become a client problem because the owner may lose coverage at an older age, after a health change, or after years of paying into the contract. It also becomes a producer problem because the file may later be reviewed through the lens of suitability, disclosure, and whether the original funding explanation was realistic. When Universal Life is sold as if flexibility removes discipline, trouble is often delayed rather than avoided. A producer who cannot explain how lapse happens should not be recommending a contract in which lapse risk is central. Preparing clients for underwriting is another place where clear speech matters. The responsible approach is to reduce surprises without promising outcomes that no producer controls. Clients should understand that medical disclosure needs to be complete and accurate. Prescription histories and other third-party data may be checked against the application. Accelerated underwriting can make the process faster and may avoid a medical exam in some cases, but it is not the same as no underwriting. It does not guarantee approval, and it does not mean the carrier stops evaluating risk. Some cases that begin on an accelerated path later move into traditional underwriting. Financial underwriting matters as well, especially in larger cases and business cases. The carrier may want to see that the amount applied for makes economic sense given income, assets, debt, or the business purpose being insured. A client who understands that process is less likely to feel ambushed by requests for records or follow-up questions. A producer who prepares the client honestly also makes placement more likely, because expectations are set correctly from the beginning. That same ethic appears in objection handling. Ethical objection handling does not try to overpower hesitation. It tries to discover whether the objection reveals a mismatch between the recommendation and the client's actual concerns. If the objection is price, the first question is not how to pressure the client into the same premium. The first question is whether the need can be met with a different structure, a different face amount, or a different duration. In many cases, the right answer to price pressure is more affordable term coverage rather than an underfunded permanent policy. If the objection is that employer coverage already exists, the responsible response is to count that coverage as part of the existing resources and then ask whether it actually closes the gap. Group coverage may help, but it does not automatically solve the full household need. If the objection is a preference for investing elsewhere, the producer should distinguish the problems being solved. Investing addresses accumulation and growth. Life insurance addresses mortality-driven liquidity and income replacement. Those functions can coexist, but they are not interchangeable. If the objection is distrust of permanent insurance, the producer should not argue that permanent is always superior. The honest answer is that permanent insurance fits some permanent needs and some client preferences, while term is often cleaner when the need is temporary or the budget is tight. If the objection is resistance to a medical exam, the producer can explain when accelerated underwriting may reduce friction, but cannot promise that every case will avoid an exam or additional evidence. In each of these situations, the ethical goal is not to win an argument. It is to discover whether the recommendation still fits after the objection is taken seriously. A household fact pattern makes this more concrete. Consider a family with two adults, young children, a mortgage, and modest liquid savings. Most of the household's long-term stability depends on one income, while the second income helps, but would not fully sustain the family alone. Existing coverage consists mainly of employer-provided life insurance and a small personal policy purchased years earlier. The initial temptation in a sales conversation might be to move quickly toward permanent insurance because cash value sounds attractive and the family wants to act responsibly. A disciplined discovery process does something else. It begins by measuring how much income would need to be replaced, which debts would require immediate payoff, what the surviving adult would need for childcare and basic living expenses, how much education funding the household hopes to preserve, and what existing assets could actually be used without damaging retirement security. It then asks about budget tolerance. Could this family reliably support a high permanent premium, or would that strain monthly cash flow? It asks about time horizon. Is the largest need concentrated in the next 15 to 25 years, or is there a genuine lifelong obligation? It asks about simplicity. Does this family want a set monthly outlay for straightforward protection, or do they want to manage flexible funding and policy performance over time? In a case like that, the answer is often that the main problem is a large temporary protection gap. The ethically strong recommendation may therefore be substantial term coverage that is large enough to protect the household during the years of dependency and debt. If conversion rights are available under the policy, they may preserve future options if health changes or a later permanent need emerges. The documentation would show why a larger amount of affordable term fits better than a smaller permanent contract. It would also show that existing employer coverage was counted, but did not eliminate the remaining gap. That is a recommendation shaped by need, not by product prestige. A business case shows the same method under greater complexity. Consider a closely held company with an owner whose family depends on business income and with a senior executive whose loss would disrupt operations. The firm may have debt, contractual obligations, and an interest in retaining key talent over time. Discovery now has to separate personal need from business need. The owner's household may need ordinary family protection. The business may separately need key person coverage, buy-sell funding, or a tool that supports executive benefit planning. Those are not the same problem, and they should not be merged into one vague sales story. If the issue is business continuity after the death of a key executive, the recommendation may center on key person coverage owned by the business. If the issue is a buy-sell obligation among owners, the analysis focuses on how an ownership transition would be funded. If the issue is long-term executive benefit financing, a more specialized institutional approach may enter the discussion, including corporate-owned life insurance. That tool should be introduced carefully. It is not a consumer default. It is a business-owned policy structure often used for key person protection or to help finance certain executive benefit arrangements. The design can be complex, and it usually requires coordination with legal, tax, and accounting advisors. A responsible producer, therefore, does not treat corporate-owned life insurance as a quick personal planning answer. The recommendation, if it is made at all, is made slowly, with a clear statement of purpose and complexity. The same discipline that improves client recommendations also prepares a candidate for interviews, especially for roles connected to New York life. A serious candidate should know more than the company's name and reputation. Before the interview begins, that candidate should understand that New York Life is a mutual insurer rather than a public stock company, and that this structure shapes how the firm speaks about policyholder value, surplus strength, and long-duration promises. The candidate should know that the company relies on an advice-led distribution model with a large field force rather than on direct digital sales alone. The candidate should understand dividend treatment on participating whole life. Dividends for eligible policies have a long history, but they are declared annually and are not guaranteed. The candidate should also know why financial strength ratings matter, without overstating their role. New York Life carries top-tier ratings from the major agencies, and that supports confidence in claims-paying ability. It does not answer the suitability question for any one client. A well-prepared candidate also knows the broader market forces around the firm. Whole life remains important in the United States market. Indexed universal life and variable universal life continue to attract attention. Accelerated underwriting and digital shopping behavior are reshaping expectations. State-based regulation, replacement rules, and careful treatment of non-guaranteed values remain central parts of the compliance landscape. Technical interview questions in this area are usually not designed to trap a candidate with obscure trivia. They test whether the candidate can explain core concepts accurately and plainly. When asked to explain term versus whole life, a sound answer stays simple. Term provides coverage for a stated period and usually no cash value. Whole life is designed for permanent coverage with fixed premiums, guaranteed cash value, and a guaranteed death benefit. Participating policies may also receive non-guaranteed dividends. The answer gets weaker when it turns into slogans about one product always being better. When asked about universal life lapse risk, a strong answer says that universal life allows flexible funding, but that flexibility does not eliminate the need to fund the policy adequately. Monthly charges continue, and if credited interest, policy value, and premium payments do not support those charges, the policy can weaken and eventually lapse. When asked to define a modified endowment contract, a strong answer says that it is a life insurance policy funded beyond the tax law limits that preserve the usual treatment of cash value access. It remains life insurance, but distributions and loans can lose some of the favorable treatment people often expect from a non-modified policy. When asked to describe suitability, a strong answer refers to reasonable inquiry into the client's objectives, finances, risk tolerance, time horizon, and current coverage, followed by a documented recommendation that actually matches those facts. When asked to summarize accelerated underwriting, a strong answer explains that carriers use application information, third-party data, and predictive methods to make some underwriting decisions more quickly, sometimes without an exam, while still reserving the right to request more evidence or move a case into traditional underwriting. Behavioral interview questions matter just as much, because the work is relational and regulated at the same time. A candidate may be asked how trust is built with a skeptical prospect. A good answer is not vague warmth. It is a process. Trust is built by listening before recommending, by separating guaranteed from non-guaranteed values, by setting expectations about underwriting and timing, and by following through on what was promised. A candidate may be asked about handling rejection. A strong answer does not pretend rejection never matters. It explains how the person stays organized, learns from objections, improves the next conversation, and does not let short-term disappointment erode professional standards. A candidate may also be asked how new regulation or company rules are learned quickly. A good answer refers to disciplined habits, reading approved materials, reviewing compliance guidance, checking state-specific requirements, and asking for clarification before speaking with confidence. A possible replacement case is another common topic. The sound answer slows the process down. It identifies existing coverage, gathers the facts on what the client already owns, follows the required notice process, compares the advantages and disadvantages carefully, and documents why replacement does or does not serve the client. A candidate may also be asked how production pressure is balanced against client interest. Here, the strongest answer is often the most direct. Insurance is a sales business, but long-term credibility depends on recommending what fits, even when the lower commission product is the right one. In general, the best answers sound specific, compliant, client-centered, and numerate. They describe actual reasoning rather than motivational generalities. They are comfortable with numbers where numbers matter, such as affordability, time horizon, or the size of a protection gap. They do not exaggerate. They are especially careful about promises. A strong candidate says what is guaranteed and what is not guaranteed, what can be known at issue and what depends on future performance, and what information would still need to be gathered before making a recommendation. That honesty is not a weakness in an interview. It signals professional judgment. The future of this work may test that judgment even more. Artificial intelligence already affects lead generation, marketing segmentation, customer service, and underwriting workflows. Online research changes the client conversation because many people arrive having read policy summaries, watched short-form explanations, or absorbed strong opinions from social media and financial influencers. Younger consumers are often comfortable gathering information online, but that does not always mean they receive a balanced explanation of guarantees, lapse risk, tax rules, or replacement consequences. At the same time, the underlying protection gap remains substantial. Awareness of life insurance stays high, yet many households remain uninsured or underinsured. That combination puts pressure on the traditional producer value proposition. If information is widely available and, quote, tools are easy to access, the human producer has to deliver something more than access. The value has to be interpretation, suitability, expectation setting, and long-term service. That is why the older habits of careful discovery and clean explanation do not become obsolete in a digital market. They become the reason a professional still matters. Several questions remain open. It is not yet clear how effectively advice-led mutual insurers that emphasize long-duration guarantees will compete in channels shaped by instant comparison and online influence. It is not yet clear whether simplified and accelerated underwriting will broaden access without also creating new confusion about who qualifies and on what basis. It is not yet clear how compensation structures and recommendation standards will evolve as regulators, firms, and consumers keep pressing for more transparency. Those are not reasons for pessimism. They are reasons to stay intellectually alert. By this stage, the central practical gains should be visible. A graduate-level listener can now explain why life insurance exists, distinguish the major product forms, separate guaranteed from non-guaranteed elements. Evaluate New York Life's market position in the context of mutual structure and product design. Conduct a disciplined discovery conversation. Recognize when deeper needs analysis is required. Speak responsibly about suitability and replacement. Prepare clients honestly for underwriting. And answer common interview questions with language that is accurate, client-centered, and compliant. The learning does not end here. Real growth comes from reading actual policy forms and illustrations, reviewing carrier underwriting guides, studying annual reports and public rating discussions, examining state insurance department materials, and listening carefully to the questions real households and businesses ask when the stakes are no longer theoretical. In life insurance, product knowledge matters, but disciplined judgment matters more. The market will keep changing. The central standard does not. Start with the need, explain the trade-offs, document the reasoning, and never confuse a possible outcome with a guaranteed promise. Sources. Key company facts came from New York Life's 2024 annual report and statutory filings, the Fortune 500 rankings, and recent ratings releases from AM Best, Fitch, Moody's, and Standard & Poor's. Those sources supported the discussion of New York Life's size, mutual ownership model, advisor network, surplus, investment holdings, dividend record, and financial strength ratings. For the broader market, the lecture leaned heavily on LIMRA sales surveys and outlook reports from 2025 and 2026. Do not quote. Those reports supplied most of the national statistics on premium growth, product mix, and forecasts for term, whole life, indexed universal life, and variable universal life. A major source on consumer behavior was the LIMRA and Life Happens Insurance Barometer Study for 2025. That study provided the figures on coverage gaps, online research habits, interest in accelerated underwriting, and the growing role of social media and AI tools in shopping for life insurance. For the longer industry view, Milliman analyses of five-year product trends and reserve practice were also important. Do not quote. Those helped explain the shift toward indexed and variable universal life, the decline of fixed universal life, principal-based reserving, and the strain in older universal life blocks with secondary guarantees. Product definitions and mechanics drew on New York Life educational guides and other public consumer references on life insurance basics. Those sources informed the plain language descriptions of term, whole life, universal life, indexed universal life, dividends, cash value, surrender, and lapse risk. For variable products and sales practice, the lecture relied on United States Securities and Exchange Commission investor education materials and public regulatory guidance on suitability. Those sources supported the explanation of investment subaccounts, market risk, flexible premiums, and the need to match complex products to a client's objectives and tolerance for risk. Tax sections were based mainly on Internal Revenue Code sections 7702 and 7702A, together with recent explanatory tax analyses. Those were the basis for the discussion of tax-qualified life insurance, the 2024 reform to Section 7702, and modified endowment contract rules, including the 7-pay test. Replacement and lapse rules came from model rules issued by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners and from State Insurance Department guidance. Those materials informed the discussion of replacement notices, disclosure duties, grace periods, and lapse notice requirements. The underwriting section also used recent consulting and reinsurance analyses of accelerated underwriting, do not quote. Those sources contributed the claims about automation, prescription histories, third-party data, faster decisions, and the sales impact of streamlined underwriting. And for cost of insurance disputes in universal life, the key legal examples came from federal and state court opinions, especially Fleischer versus Phoenix Life and Lincoln National Insurance Company versus Bezic. Those cases were used to illustrate how courts have interpreted contract language around cost of insurance increases. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.